Let me just start the recording and just say to say that we're gonna start again about now. So we're continuing. This is parallel session A, and we're continuing now with talks about detectors in large scale HEP experiments. And first up, we have Thomas Kerr talking about sustainability at Bell 2. So yes, please go ahead. Take it away, Thomas.
Okay, yeah, thanks a lot. I'm happy to report that also at the Bell 2 experiment, there are now some activities on sustainability. And yeah, so in this talk, I want to show where we stand. Okay, so first, what is Bell 2? So we are an experiment at the Super KB Collider in Japan. So there we collide electrons and positrons at the center of mass energy of roughly 10.5 GeV. And here we then produce pairs of B mesons, charm hadrons, tau leptons. So these are the objects we are studying. And we want to do this with very high precision. So we are at the intensity frontier. So we aim to collect 50 times more data than the predecessor experiment Bell. The sustainability discussion started maybe a year ago, roughly. So in October 2023, we had the first discussion in the institutional board. So this is what is often called also collaboration board, so where the institutes which are participating in the experiment are represented. And then we followed up with a survey. So, and I will show results of the survey then in the following slides. Then in May this year, we had the first Bell 2 sustainability meeting, so open to everybody. It was a virtual meeting at times convenient for Asia and Europe, but inconvenient for America. So we had little participants from there. So overall, about 20 people participated. And then, last week we had an update, so reported on this sustainability, first sustainability was in the institutional board. And we also had a meeting with KAK, so this is the host lab of the experiment. So then, coming to the survey, so we had 189 participants. So the collaboration is roughly 1,000 people. So this is quite good turnout. We had physicists, so staff, so permanent postdocs. This is here in green, this part, and PhD students in orange. These are the main participants in the survey. So you also see here the fraction of physicists, permanent and postdoc, PhD students, and also emeritus is order of 20-25%. The participation from technical members and master and bachelor students was considerably lower. One can, of course, also look how's the distribution regionally. So here it's split in Europe, America, and Asia Pacific region. So in Europe and America, roughly 20% of the Bell 2 members filled the survey. In Asia Pacific region, this is below 10%. So there's some trend visible between Europe, America, and Asia Pacific. So then first we asked, do you think there's a human caused climate change? And here really most of the people say yes. A few will say don't know or don't care, and very few will say no. Also, if you ask whether people think it's urgent to do something about the climate change, most of them say yes. Some don't know, don't care, and also a few say no. Here it's also then broken down by membership category. I mean, also there's no big difference visible. If you break it down by regions, you can see maybe in Asia there are a few more see it not as that urgent to do something. But also here, when you see it's roughly 80%, also in Asia, say it's urgent to do so. And yeah, then after now having the opinion that it is urgent, so one can also ask how large do we expect the impact to be? First, in general, here most people think it's severe. Yeah, some people think it's moderate and very small fraction negligible. Broken down by a category, membership category, maybe one sees here for emeritus, the fraction who expects only a moderate impact is a bit higher than for the other category. So maybe there's also some correlation with age. I mean, emeritus, of course, older members here, master's students, technical PhD students are usually younger colleagues. And the trend we have seen before also with Asia Pacific region, also there the impact is in general considered less severe. So this was the impact in general. Now we can also ask what impact do we expect on BEL2, on our experiment? And so here we gave a few options, less support by the society, reduced funding, and imposed limitations on CO2 or energy consumption. And this is something, some consequences, a majority of BEL2 members expects such an impact. Also here broken down by membership category and region. So I think the trend more or less between these three outcomes or these three impacts is similar for these categories and also regions. Then next question was who should act, who should do something against climate change? And here most people, almost 100%, governments should do something. Then next are I myself, so also people think they themselves should do something. And then the BEL2 experiment and the own institute are here, a little bit above 50%. Also here you see for emeritus, maybe the need or the responsibility is less seen by individuals or institutes or experiments than for others. Okay, then so to summarize, I think we had some good participation in this survey. We also had 51 additional free text comments, so people really cared and wanted to share their opinions. So I think this was very good. So we can conclude that climate change is a topic in the BEL2 collaboration. And also we expect a negative impact both in general, but also on our experiment. The major responsibility to do something is seen as the responsibility of governments, but there's also a slight majority which sees the need for BEL2 to act. So then, so what can we do? Where are we? So this is what we have to address next. And so I will then show also some numbers, but these are really rough estimates, no official numbers. So this is, of course, what we have to address to collect numbers more systematically, more reliably. But we can start with some order of magnitude estimates. So starting with the detector, we have a power consumption of roughly 3 gigawatt hours per year. If you now take the energy mix in Japan, this corresponds to roughly 1.4 kilotons CO2 equivalent per year. Then, as we have seen before at the LHC experiments, the gases are actually the main have the main impact on the climate. So here we use gases in our drift chamber and for the cooling of the vertex detector, but there we expect a very small impact. Most comes from this outer detector where we detect muons and K-long particles. So here, maybe 2 kilotons per year are the impact of leaks of or of the emission of this gas, which is there in the RPCs. So yeah, this is something we should, of course, monitor really to get really reliable number here and investigate reusing, recirculating this gas in this outer detector. Also for upgrades, of course, what we should do is consider then the footprint of the gases we plan to use then. The next topic is computing. So here we can look at what's the CPU usage here in kilo HAPSPEC 06. If we take this value and assume some conversion factor between watts to kilo HAPSPEC and watts, then this is roughly 1 gigawatt hour per year, which is yeah more than an order of magnitude smaller than what Atlas and CMS have, which seems reasonable. So of course, the CO2 footprint then also depends on where the computing center is located. And this only includes the CPU. There's also for storage network, and this is only grid. There are other resources. But if you compare this number here with this, it's yeah, similar of order of magnitude as for the detector. So what we discussed, what one can do is to do this more systematically and really have a CO2 footprint as we do an accounting for kilohertz and kilohertz for the CPU usage. Also a footprint report per user job might motivate the users to work more resource efficiency, more resource efficient. So yeah, Ben has mentioned the talk before. This is done for user jobs at DeeZee already. So this is what people really appreciate. And maybe if users also have the option to decide to which jobs they submit their work, they can save maybe CO2 footprint by running at sites which have better energy mix. And of course, a systematic software optimization is something which can help. Then travel is probably dominated by travel to our collaboration meetings, so BELTU general meetings, B2GMs. And here we did some estimate, assuming a direct flight from the home country of the participant to the location of the collaboration meeting. And so here in blue, we have a meeting that took place in Japan, Tsukuba, at the location of the experiment. And then we had also one collaboration meeting in Rome. And then we can do the calculation and see what we get. And you see here the total CO2 emission for this meeting in Rome is much lower. Also, if you look as now per participant, but here one has to also take into account that this was still during pandemic, so very people from Japan, for example, participate, which you can also see here if you break down the CO2 contribution by yeah, country or region. So therefore, what we also did, assuming the participants of the collaboration meeting that took place in Japan, if they would travel to Rome, these are then these green bars you see here, of course, large number then for Japan. So then the total CO2 footprint would be similar also per participant. But of course, if a meeting is in Europe, probably more people from Europe, less people from Asia would come. So there might be some potential of saving. Also, might be more inclusive if then at different collaboration meetings, different people can join. So this is something we want to consider. We have our collaboration meetings not only in Japan, but also abroad. At least some of them. And in general, of course, be more conscious about why we travel. And then if we have in-person meetings, use the time efficiently. What we will also do then next is to collect the information which travel route people take at the registration of the collaboration meetings. There are, of course, other travels for shifts and for conferences. So there we want to get first some estimate how it compares to this travel for collaboration meetings and see whether it makes sense to also collect data more in more detailed way there. And one thing we can consider is that, of course, it's more efficient if you stay for a longer period of time on site. So this is something which we could give preference to. Then, of course, we have the accelerator operated by KEK, the host lab. And here, really, the main impact comes from power consumption. And in Japan, of course, it's worse than in France. You also see from which sources the energy comes. You see, for example, here, a sharp drop in nuclear power. But what is maybe encouraging, you see some rise here of solar and maybe wind, not that much. But so also here, renewable energies might be rising, which might of course help. Then there are several measures also discussed in the host lab, like using solar panels or reusing the heat from the accelerator. So I think this would be a separate talk in its own. And so I don't want to go into details here. So overall, for the lab, the goal is to be carbon neutral in 2050, which is the goal of the Japanese government. So to summarize, there's increasing interest in sustainability in the Belt-Roux collaboration. Grassroots initiative started, and so we collected several ideas and have to see what can be implemented. We are also discussing of some organizational structure to have sustainability somewhere as a topic represented there. And we are, of course, then looking forward to an exchange and collaboration with corresponding initiatives at other experiments. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Questions? Okay, I can maybe ask one quick question. I feel like Belt-2 is sort of unique in particle physics, at least for running experiments at the moment, being located in Japan with lots of contributors from Europe. And I mean, and also just thinking about this meeting, I think try as we might to encourage people from all over the world to attend, realistically, we have lots of people from Europe and the Americas here. So I was wondering if you have any insights, I mean, anything that's unique to your collaboration, or anything that you've sort of learned, because of course, sustainability is, you know, a political as well as, you know, a social issue. Is there, this isn't a very well-formulated question, but is there anything that you're seeing with, you know, this the experiment being located in Japan that you have realized is you know, that we should really be thinking about all over the world?
Okay. So the question is basically, are there differences between an experiment in Japan and an experiment in Europe in terms of sustainability or anything?
Or in terms of dealing with the sustainability and putting plans into action, maybe.
I think most challenges and probably also solutions, I guess, are similar. I think during the pandemics, we managed quite well doing remote. So that's maybe Belt-2 is I think more doing more meetings remote maybe than collaboration at CERN, I have the impression, which might be good for CO2 footprint, but of course it's I mean, for collaboration and social interaction, it's maybe a disadvantage. Otherwise, maybe there are, of course, different mentalities sometimes in Asia and in Europe. And you also saw in the survey there was a slight tendency maybe in Asia. But I would also say there, the majority, at least that those who participate in the survey, see this as a problem. And so maybe in the end, the differences are not that large.
Okay, then absolutely can definitely be the case. Thank you. Okay, I see we're actually running a little bit behind time, and it's my fault. So unless there's any other burning questions, actually, if you have more questions, feel free to follow up in Mattermost. If not, we move on. I need the agenda. Next is Gregory Halliwell talking about the green use of fluorocarbons in Trenkov detectors and detector cooling systems.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, I'll try and get my slides on to full screen mode. You see it full screen?
Yes, now we do.
Okay,
Please go
great.
ahead.
Okay, so yeah, I'm going to talk about fluorocarbons and different kinds of fluorocarbons. And this talk relates to a paper that was published in Europhysics Journal Plus late last year. And also some talks I've given in ECFA DRD4. That's the DRD4 working group for particle identification. And this talk is going to consider fluorocarbons in Cherenkov detectors and also in detector cooling applications. Many people gave me information for that paper that's circled in red there, and they're thanked in the link in the paper itself. Okay, so I don't know what the audience in this meeting is going to be, so I wanted to say something just about Cherenkov radiation. And it's very similar to the kind of shockwave you get from a supersonic aircraft. This is, I think, an F-18. And what happens is that when the speed of the particle exceeds the speed of light in the particular transparent medium, you get this cone of Cherenkov radiation, which is coherent. And it has an opening angle which increases with particle velocity up to a plateau value. And the name of the game is to identify the particles from the radius of the Cherenkov ring. And the problem is that the intensity of the light is very small, so you need a very big volume of gas. So, as I said, the ring radius is found, it's from the positions of detected Cherenkov photons in a photon detector of some sort of plane of detectors. And the volumes of these detectors are the biggest volumes of any detectors, I think, in particle physics. They can be 100 cubic meters. So, for example, Rich one, I think it is in Rich two in LHCb has got a volume of 100 cubic meters of fluorocarbon gas, and the Compass Rich has got 100 cubic meters. So you can see already now you're talking about gases that may have a big footprint because of the volume. So this is an example of the typical geometry of a Rich detector, and right now we use saturated fluorocarbons, which have this chemical formula. If you've got n carbons, you've got 2n plus 2 fluorines. These are chosen for their optimum refractive index, but they're very high GWP gases. Now, these saturated fluorocarbons in general have excellent properties, which is why they've been used in particle physics for decades. They're non-flammable, they're non-toxic. If you have a leak, they're non-conducting. They're very good dielectrics in their own right. They have convenient thermodynamics if you want to recirculate them. They've got low viscosity, so they go down colder than water, for example, for cooling. They're non-ozone depleting, and very importantly, they're radiation resistant because of these very strong carbon-fluorine bonds. But the corollary to that is that the stability gives them very high GWPs, and they're typically in the range 5,000 to 9,000 times CO2. For a bit of perspective, sulfur hexafluoride is the worst gas of all. It's used at CERN in small applications. That's 23,000 times the GWP of CO2. Okay, now molecular shape is very important in terms of GWP. And this slide compares the saturated fluorocarbons with this chemical formula and their various uses at CERN. So, for example, CF4 is used in as a Rich detector gas. So is C4F10 in LHCb and Compass. C6F14 is used as a ubiquitous liquid coolant, and C3F8 is used for evaporative cooling, for example, of the Atlas silicon tracker. You can see underneath there are the analogs of these, and these are the fluoroketone analogs where you've kicked out two fluorines and you've replaced it with an oxygen. And if you look at the ones that are currently in production, industrial production, which is shown in green, the benefit of having that oxygen atom on a side spur of the molecule is that GWP is zero or one, equivalent to CO2 itself. At the light end of the spectrum, these fluids would be very nice to have, but they're not in industrial production. And you can imagine, for example, that if you wanted to replace the fluorocarbon radiator of LHCb-rich 2, which is CF4, CF2O would be a very probably have very similar performance, optical performance. So the oxygen position is very important on the molecule. And the fluids that you'd like to have available would be, for example, for cooling, replacing C6F14 here on the right with a fluid, which is C6F12O, which is actually in production right now by 3M and other companies. For rich detector like LHCb, it would be good to replace C4F10 with C4F8O. And then at the other end of the spectrum, the one I've already said. A fluid that would be ideal for cooling silicon trackers, and I'll get on to that, evaporative cooling, would be this fluid which doesn't exist in industrial quantities yet, C4F2O. I'll come on to that later. Now, you've got to be very careful how you construct the molecule. So if you take C4F8O, there's different isomers that you can have. And the isomers you don't want are the molecules where the oxygen forms part of the closed ring, because if you do that, you've got a very stable molecule and it has a very high GWP. Optically, it's fine, but it's not a good molecule. This is another intermediate shape where the molecule, the oxygen, is in a linear molecule, which is not closed. I don't know what the footprint of that is. It's probably not as good as this configuration here. This is the what we call linear configuration, where the molecule is linear and the oxygen is on a sidearm, an exposed sidearm. That's the kind of geometry molecule you'd like for all these applications. Now, looking at the recent CERN environmental reports, I'm starting with the 2019-2021, there were some comments about emissions, obviously, and the fluorocarbon contributions to those emissions. And if you take the fluorocarbons that are used at CERN in their various applications, for example, LHCb-rich 2, and cooling, C6F14, and you look at the contribution from escapes of these fluids, during 2019-2020, I think during the pandemic, when there was less activity at CERN, the CO2 equivalent emission was around 45,000 tons from these saturated fluorocarbons. That actually corresponds, if you fold in the GWPs, of a loss of only around 7 tons of fluid, which when you think about the size of the LHC installations, the 4 big experiments and all the other industrial services, is actually a very small weight of fluid that's lost. What also was commented in this 2019-2020 report was that, well, NOVEC was grouped on the same line as other fluorocarbon gases, including sulfur hexafluoride, which I found to be very disingenuous. I made some comments about that. I don't know whether I was listened to, but I think comparing NOVEC C6F12O, which has a GWP of zero, combining that on the same line as something with 23,000 is grossly unfair. I think we have to be honest in this kind of work. Anyway, moving on to the most recent environmental report, then the perfluorocarbons are shown here. There's more loss now because LHC is running. There's more consumption in cooling and in detectors. And sulfur hexafluoride now has been separated out into its own line away from, almost its own line away from other fluids. This NOVEC 649 with GWP of zero is still grouped with some other fluids which are GWPs in a range of 1,000. So it's still slightly unfair, but okay, it's better than it was. The same report commented that LHCb had installed a new CF4 recovery plant. This is the Rich 2 radiator gas, which is good. What it didn't mention was that Atlas has an extensive ultrasonic fluorocarbon leak monitoring system to look for leaks of C3F8 from the silicon tracker, which plays a big role in monitoring leak rates. And the system that's used is ultrasonic gas analysis. So if you have two gases of very different molecular weights, and C3F8 and these fluorocarbons are very heavy in molecular weight, leaking into a light carrier, then you can have a very good sensitivity for detecting the molar concentration. And in fact, you can use the ultrasonics, you can use the speed of sound in a feedback loop to actively blend gases to, if you wanted to synthesize the same refractive index as a gas that you might want to replace in a Cherenkov detector. This paper talks about the analysis algorithms and all that kind of thing. Okay, so what gives these fluoroketones their low GWP? And it seems to be the way scission occurs of these molecules in the upper atmosphere, which were at low pressure with high ultraviolet concentrations. And depending whether this is the oxygen atom on the side spur, and scission of the molecule on either side tends to produce debris that does not have a long atmospheric lifetime, for reasons I don't really understand because I'm not a chemist or an environmental scientist, but there's a paper there which discusses that in some detail. Two papers there, you can see the links to them. And it's to do with the action of 300 nanometer photons, UV photons in the upper atmosphere. Okay, so coming to the Cherenkov detector perspective, this is LHCb, which has two Cherenkov detectors. If you take a typical Cherenkov detector with a volume V, which could be as much as 100 cubic meters, you can calculate the GWP load of that volume of gas, and it depends on the density, the volume, and the GWP of the individual components. And you can have a ton equivalent of that volume of gas. Remember, these are the biggest volume detectors in particle physics, or can be. And the refractive index, which is what you care about when you're doing particle identification, is given by the weighted sum of the refractive indices of the different components multiplied by their molar concentrations. And what you can do is that you can blend a small concentration of a heavy fluorocarbon or one of these fluoroketones with a light gas like nitrogen to replicate the refractive index of a saturated fluorocarbon with a high GWP, and you can reduce the GWP load of this volume of gas. And this is something that is now being actively looked at. Now, you can use a fluoroketone like one of these oxygenated molecules, or you could even use heritage saturated fluorocarbons, heavy saturated fluorocarbons in a small molar concentration. This is an example here from that paper in Europhysics Plus. So if you look at, for example, LHCb Rich 2, which is 100 cubic meters, that contains CF4. The load equivalent of that is around 1,700 tons of CO2. Now, what you can do is mix a heavy heritage fluorocarbon. These are not used anymore, but there's probably still stocks at CERN, C5F12. It has a high intrinsic GWP, but you can mix it in a low molar concentration, and you can reduce the GWP load of that radiator volume by a factor of 2. Now, of course, if you used a fluoroketone, you could reduce it to 0. So that's the case for a CF4 radiator. And in fact, if you use ultrasonics to help you blend these two gases, what you measure in real time is the speed of sound in a gas mixture. And from that, you can get to the speed of light in the gas. And what you can then do is find the concentration of for example, C5F12 or C4F10 with nitrogen that gives you the Cherenkov thresholds you want for the different particle species. And this is what you need to do in a Cherenkov detector. And the beauty of this is that if you used 14% of Novec 5110, which is this C5F10O, you reduce the GWP load of that radiator by 1,700 tons. And even if you use this heritage C5F12, you'd reduce it by 800 tons. And in real time, by measuring the speed of sound, you can see where you are in terms of concentration of the heavy component.
Sorry to interrupt. You just have 1 or 2 minutes left. Thank you.
Right. If you take a gas like a radiator like Compass, then you can do the same game and you can reduce the GWP load as well. So CERN has tested this fluid, this fluoroketone. It has similar radiation resistance to C6F14, which is used as a coolant. However, its water concentration needs to be looked at carefully because there can be some nasty humidity effects. Moving on quickly, the fluorocarbons are used extensively in the semiconductor industry. It's not really reasonable to expect that the semiconductor industry is going to fold because of a lack of fluorocarbons. Vapor phase soldering is used to make all sorts of complicated printed circuit boards. Let me move on to silicon trackers. Now, one of the problems with silicon trackers is that you have even more fluorocarbons if it's a fluorocarbon system, because we could have a ton in liquid phase of a fluorocarbon. Now, this has motivated a switch to CO2 as the coolant which recirculates through tracking detectors. This is for the LHC upgrades, the high luminosity LHC upgrades. However, it's now apparent that CO2 cannot cool silicon sufficiently low in temperature to prevent certain radiation damage in some tracker geometries. And this is becoming more and more recognized. And the question is, if you take the Atlas silicon tracker, there's plans to replace the inner part of the upgraded Atlas silicon tracker halfway through the high luminosity LHC program. There's a trade-off here between a carbon footprint of having to replace a massive chunk of a silicon tracker with using an optimized coolant, which would mean that you didn't have to replace the tracker. And that's, I think, an important point, particularly trackers which are built in this tube and block geometry, where you have long tubes and cooling blocks. These are the ones which need to be cooled to a lower temperature. The coolant in the pipes needs to be at a lower temperature because there's a lot of thermal resistance between the coolant and the silicon itself. If you take microvertex cooling like in LHCb Velo, then the thermal powers are much smaller, much shorter, and you can have the coolant a little bit warmer. So that really does work well with CO2, and it's been proved to work by the LHCb collaboration. This is an example of the Atlas, a tube and block geometry. This is the Atlas ITK. And this whole region here is due to be replaced halfway through the high luminosity program of LHC. Now, this CO2 problem has been recognized, and a krypton evaporative system, a very complex one, has been proposed to replace CO2 so that you can protect the silicon against radiation damage at this high luminosity. The colder you can keep the silicon, the longer it will live. A better adaptation would be one of these fluoroketones in the same cooling tubes, C2F4O, which doesn't currently exist in an industrial form. This would allow colder operation and might mean that you didn't need to replace this part of the tracker. And here's some thermodynamic diagrams, which I won't bore you with too much, except to say that C3F8 and CO2 probably won't go cold enough. C2F6 is a fluorocarbon that exists now. It's got a very high GWP, but its analog as a fluoroketone is C2F4O, which could work. A xenon is another possibility, but it's extremely expensive, particularly since the war in Ukraine. Okay, So I produced a SWOT analysis for these different fluids, which if you've got the time and the interest, you can look at the slides to see. One problem is that there is a European directive to try to reduce all fluorocarbon use. It's a little bit like a sledgehammer to crack a nut, I think. There are a lot of fluids that society just can't do without. If you're interested in this program of trying to identify fluorocarbons to phase out, there's various links here that you can look at. I think the important thing to understand is that the electronics industry is the biggest driver in all this, and Western prosperity depends enormously on that. So there's a lot of impracticalities probably in phasing a lot of these fluids, although, of course, we are seeing fluorocarbons more and more in seawater and the food chain. Anyway, there's some screenshots from this ECHA, European Chemical Agency website, if you're interested. So this is the summary. Is the banning of these fluorocarbons a realistic aim? Not all of them. Perhaps the saturated fluorocarbons, yes, because of their high GWPs. The alternative fluorocarbons, I don't think the fluoroketone shouldn't be thrown away. It's like throwing away the baby with the bathwater. But more material compatibility studies need to be done. 3M seem to have lost their enthusiasm to produce any fluorocarbons, but there are other companies that I've spoke to who say they have no plans to stop. And there's an active research now by groups at CERN looking into alternative suppliers to maintain the future of these rich detectors. But we're small scale users. We'll always ride on the back of the semiconductor industry. So in conclusion, I think we should our discussion should concentrate on these linear CnF2NO molecules over the full carbon spectrum. Fluoroketones are very important for future cooling, C6F12O for liquid cooling, this new fluid C2F4O for evaporative cooling of block and tubes, silicon trackers. And then the fluoroketones, which are relevant to ring imaging Cherenkov detectors, are the linearized C4F8O for compass and rich LACB rich one, and then also CF2O for rich two if you wanted to directly substitute CF4. Or, of course, you could do this blending using acoustics to help you. Okay, so that's all I have. Oh, well, I have various references as backup material for anyone who's interested. Okay. That's all I need to say today.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Questions? I think we have time for one quick one. Okay, maybe just quickly. You say we're small scale users who always ride on the back of the semiconductor industry. I think that that's definitely true, but I mean, can we have any influence there? Can we captivate the attention of the public and bring them into this? You know, I think many people in various walks of life are interested in sustainability. I don't know, do we have any influence there?
When I spoke to companies like F2 Chemicals in the UK, I spoke to two people from that company, and they said, listen, we're not even going to start making saturated fluorocarbons because they're so vital right now in semiconductor manufacture. We have no plans to phase these out. Something seems to have happened to discourage 3M. One of the things I haven't talked about, because I don't really know anything about it, we need to find out, is what the carbon footprint is of actually producing these fluoroketones. If, for example, you let a lot of other fluorocarbons into the atmosphere in an industrial plant that produces these fluoroketones, then that's obviously a bad thing. And maybe this is what's 3M has motivated 3M to lose enthusiasm in producing fluorinated fluids, but I don't know the real reason. So can we influence them? I'm not sure, to be honest. People, for example, from ALICE, and also the BTEV collaboration managed to get some C4F8O, which they used in prototype Cherenkov detectors. But they actually got the ring molecule, which had a high GWP, because it wasn't realized at that point that you needed a linearized molecule. CERN has a kudos associated with it, so it may well be that we can leverage that to some extent. I mean, I think we need to start talking. We also need to try to play companies off against one another. I mean, there's a French company that makes these fluoroketones, for example, which isn't in this list. There are several companies in China, and I think people at CERN are looking into those at those various suppliers. I think it's important to try to get them to compete with each other.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks. That's a good point. Okay, I think that's we need to move on. So thank you again. Okay. And now I think next is Luca Quaglia talking about green transition of RPC detectors for HEPA applications.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, then I will share my screen. Okay. So thanks a lot, first of all, for reaching out and providing me with this opportunity. As it was said, I will quickly give an overview of the green transition of resistive plate chambers in high energy physics. So I will start with a brief discussion on the employment of RPCs at the LHC. Then I will discuss the currently employed gas mixture and the environmental issues that it poses. Then I will do a quick tangential discussing the gas consumption of RPCs at LHC. And then I will provide two different case studies on how we are trying to reduce the impact of RPC emissions at CERN. So here I reported some the examples of where RPCs are used at LHC. For example, in ALICE, we use RPCs. So I say we because I'm from ALICE. Sorry, I didn't say. We use RPCs in the muon identification system. They cover an area of 140 meters square, and their operation is foreseen for the whole duration of the experiment. In LHCb, the RPCs are not yet installed, but they are being considered as a possibility in the muon detection for the phase two upgrade. In CMS, the RPCs cover a very large area of 3,000 meters square, and they have been operating during run one and run two, and also there is an upgrade ongoing for ILUMI LHC, and so is ATLAS, so they also cover a very large area. So this is all to say that the RPC technology, even if it's a very simple one, it's still very much used, so these are still very important detectors. The currently employed mixtures at LHC is mainly composed by three different gases, which are used in different concentrations for the different experiments, but pretty much the gases are the R134a that you can see here, the isobutane, and the SF6. The role of the R134a is to provide a high density of primary ion electron pairs. The isobutane acts as a quenching gas, meaning that it captures the photons produced by the recombination without further ionization. And then the SF6, which has a high electron affinity, is used to capture some of the free electrons to reduce the spatial size of the discharge. I will then describe why this mixture is not environmentally friendly a bit later. I will now focus on the gas emission. So this plot was already shown. Just quickly, this is the scope one emission of CERN. So this means the direct emission from facilities and vehicles. This emission is expressed in equivalent tons of CO2 and it's reported per year. You can see that during run two and also at the start of run three, most of the emission is due by particle detection and detector cooling, most of all. And you can also see this green line, which is the target goal of consumption that is needed to be reached by the end of run three in 2025, which represents 28% less emission than in 2018. And we are not yet at this goal. This is a table that I also saw that it was reported earlier. It reports the different emission by gases. And the main emitter, the main consumer of the R134a and SF6 are the RPC detectors. In order to highlight this, I've also reported this figure that I've taken from an old talk of Beatrice Mandelli at the ECFA Detector R&D Roadmap, where I have reported the consumption of the RPCs in the main LHC experiment. So we have Atlas, Alice, we have two different types of RPCs in Alice, and also CMS. So you can see that this is, again, reported in equivalent tons of CO2. You can see, for example, for Atlas and for CMS, that going from run 1 to run 2, there was an increase of emission by the RPCs, and this is due to the appearance of some leaks at the detector level. And during the long shutdown 2, there was a very intensive leak repair campaign. I have reported here a couple of references to some presentations where this leak campaign is discussed. And so they managed to recover some of them. And in CMS, they also managed to shut down some input channels to reduce the leaks. And the data from the run 3 consumption still have to be produced. So this is updated only up to the long shutdown 2 of LHC. On a positive note, instead, you can see that, for example, for the Alice RPCs, in both cases, there was a reduction of the consumption between run 1 and run 2. And I will describe as a case study how we managed to reach this, this situation. So, as I anticipated earlier, the problem with the RPC mixture is that they contain a high fraction of R134a and SF6. These gases are fluorinated greenhouse gases, and there have been new European Union regulations to reduce the impact of this kind of gases. And in particular, they are articulated in three main points. They want to phase down the production and the use of F-gases. They want to ban these gases if there is a more eco-friendly alternative. And they also want to reduce the emission from existing equipment. And this will lead to an increase in cost and a reduction in availability, which we are already starting to see now with the R134a, because there are some substitutes that are being used in the industry. What I've reported here is just a chart of the expected placement on the market of the F-gases, starting from the new European Union regulations that were enforced here. And I also have reported on top the equivalent period in LHC run. So this is the long shutdown 2, and this is the long shutdown 3. So the black line is the expected quantity to be placed on the market, and the blue one is the one that was actually placed on the market. And you can see that by 2030, it's planned to reach the, a level of 20% with respect to the original emission in 2014. At CERN, there are different ways in which this issue is being tackled, and I will, as I said, report here a couple of examples. One of them is the gas mixture recirculation, and the other one, where I'm more personally involved, is the search for alternative gas mixtures. And for lack of time, and also for lack of my knowledge, I have reported here a reference to a talk by Beatrice, where she discusses in details the other possibilities to reduce greenhouse gases emission. So I will start with a quick description of the RPC gas system in ALICE. So we have this detector that you can see here. It's made up of 72 resistive plate chambers, which are used to provide muon trigger and identification. They cover a total area of 140 meters squared. They are divided into four different planes. And the gas mixture is composed by 89.7% R134a, 10% isobutane, and 0.3% SF6, leading to a GWP of around 1,400. In particular, then, the total volume is only 0.3 meters square, and we flush the system continuously at 0.5 volume per hour changes. And during the LHC run 1, the gas system was operated in open loop mode. So all the gas mixture was simply flushed in the atmosphere. This was done because during normal operation, There are some pollutants that are produced in the gas, and if these pollutants are not removed and the gas is simply reinjected in the chambers, they could lead to a worsening of the detector performance. So in order to recirculate the gas, you need to insert some purifying elements in the gas loop. And there was a feasibility study done between 2016 and 2017, and now the circulation is in place since round two. So this feasibility study consisted in monitoring the so-called dark current, meaning that this is the current flowing when there is no beam. So in principle, we expect a zero current when there is no beam, so no particles passing in the RPCs. But in any case, due to detector imperfections, we still see a bit of current. And an increase of this could be due to the deposition of some impurities. So here I have reported some plots of the average dark current of the 72 RPCs for different gas recirculation fractions, meaning that, recirculation fraction means the percentage of gas that you recirculate with respect to the total gas. Indeed, the recirculation cannot be 100%. We still inject a little bit of gas. You can see that it seems there was an increase of the dark current increasing the recirculation fraction, but then it plateaued around 70%. Then we increased to 75% and still there was an increase. Then we reduced to 50% and we saw no change. And then the dark current got more stable. So in the end, it was decided to stay with a high recirculation fraction of above 80%. And now we are at a recirculation fraction of 87%. What was the effect? Here I have reported the consumption of R134A and SF6 for the RPCs. This is during run one. Here we started to do some feasibility studies, and then here we recirculated with 80%. And you can see that there was a reduction of a factor three in gas emission. So this is very, very good. And from run three onwards, we are operating the detectors at a lower voltage because of new front-end electronics. So still less impurities are produced. So it is possible that we will manage to increase the recirculation fraction even more. So even above 90%. And this is currently under study. And in Atlas and CMS, the recirculation fraction is also above 90%. So their problem is the leaks, but for the recirculation, it's pretty high. The other strategy that I want to do, that I want to discuss a little bit, is the search for a new and more eco-friendly mixture. In particular, now we are focused on the replacement of the R134A, since it's the main contributor to the GWP of the mixture. And in the industry, this gas is being substituted using gases from the hydrofluoroolefin or HFO families, which have, as you can see here, a very similar chemical structure to the R134A, but a much lower GWP. In particular, two of the HFOs are of interest, the HFO 1234YF and ZE. These are two isomers of the same gas. And our search is focused on the ZE because the YF is reported to be mildly flammable. So for safety reasons, it cannot be used. The replacement of the full replacement of R134A with HFO is not possible because the working voltage would shift to values that are much higher than what we have now. Today we are around 10 kilovolt and they would move to above 15 kilovolts. So the HFO has to be diluted with other gases. And there have been several studies using cosmic rays, and the CO2 was found to be the most promising candidate for the dilution. And the GWP of CO2 is one, so this is acceptable. And now we created this collaboration between the different LHC experiments in order to join the forces and perform what we call aging studies, which means operate the detector for a long time under a high level of irradiation, to monitor the evolution of the performance in time. And this is done to simulate the operating conditions in the experiments, but we accumulate the charge in a much faster period. So for example, instead of operating for 10 years, you can operate the detector for 1 year and see what happens. And we do the test at the gamma irradiation facility of CERN, where we have this high activity cesium source to simulate these aging studies. And then we use a periodic beam test with a muon beam to study the evolution of the detector performance in time. I'm almost finished. These are some photos of our experimental setup. We have two trolleys, one at 3 meters and one at 6 meters from the source. And each member of the collaboration has provided one detector to be tested, and they are placed at different distances due to different requests of the experiments. And we have a common gas system, high voltage, and also acquisition system. We have two publications, one paper and one preprint. This is open access, so you can have a look, where we discuss some of the preliminary results that we obtained. And here I have reported just a few screenshots of important results. For example, this is the stability of the current absorbed as a function of the integrated charge with one of the eco-friendly mixtures that we chose. These are some efficiency curves that we took with different mixtures with different HFO and CO2 concentrations that we got using the muon beam. And this is these are charge spectra that we took with a standard mixture and with a couple of eco-friendly mixtures. And an interesting observation here is that the average charge per heat is much higher for the eco-friendly mixtures. This is because the HFO is ionized more easily than R134a, so the average charge per heat is larger. And this is something that we have to closely monitor. The last slide is the integrated charge over time for all the detectors of the collaboration. So in general, for the HiLumi LHC, different experiments plan to integrate different charge. For example, in ALICE, we plan to integrate roughly 70 millicoulomb per centimeter square, while CMS and ATLAS, they plan to integrate 1 coulomb per centimeter square. You can see that we reached roughly 200 millicoulomb per centimeter square with all the detectors that need this amount of charge. And we monitor continuously the RPC performance, and we saw a quite stable behavior, except for a slight increase of the dark current, which we are now trying to keep under study and try to understand what could be the origin of this. So I will leave you with the conclusions here, and I'm available for questions.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. And also thanks for staying in time.
Yeah, thank you.
Questions. I see one from Hannah.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for the great talk. So I had quite a simple question, actually. So in the middle, around, I think, slide 9, you showed your run 2 and like how the SF impacts had changed over time. And realistically, they are going down overall, which is great. How hopeful are you for that to like be reflected within like run 3, run 4, etc.? Do you think it's going to continue this like pretty visible drop, or do you think there's going to be a plateau where we just physically can't reduce it anymore?
Yeah, so I don't have the data from now. It's still being produced because this data, as I said here, is always provided by Beatrice. She's one of the gas team experts, and she's working on producing the latest data. The reason of the decrease is that because we started the recirculation, then, of course, if you increase a bit the recirculation fraction, you will see a slight decrease. But realistically, for now, I would say we are on the same order of magnitude. And as I quickly said, we are now trying to see if we can increase slightly the recirculation fraction. But in any case, you cannot go above 95%, I would say. And now we are roughly at 87%, so we can increase 8 percentage points more, but not more than that. So realistically, this is what we can do. And also in our case, since we employ a mixture that is considered slightly flammable, we are completely without leaks. So in our case, really, we have much less RPCs than CMS and ATLAS, of course. We have 72 while they have 1,000. So in our case, it's much, much easier to access all the detectors. And really, any time after a long shutdown, we check chamber by chamber to see if we have leaks. So we don't lose anything in leaks. And this is really only needed to inject a bit of fresh gas every time.
Thank you.
Yep, welcome.
Okay, let's take one more question in the interest of not having all the questions just from the session conveners. So Veronique, please.
Yes, very quick. Thanks again for this. On your slide 10, I'm thinking of future detectors since RPCs are such great detectors. And indeed, one of the complications with the LH experiments is that you're not replacing the whole thing, right? So a lot of the legacy chambers are still there. And also the high voltage is fixed and is not planned to be replaced. And so if you were to design a new detector, which will use RPCs, then in your, of course, you're not given the parameters of that detector necessarily, but is your impression that the situation would be much, much easier? It would be, for example, possible to do a one-to-one replacement with the HFO, because then you can have a different voltage, that kind of thing. Is that your impression?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't think so, mainly because this gas, being less, being more eco-friendly, let's say, its bonds are more easily broken. So in principle, it's producing more pollutants. So this could in turn worsen a lot the longevity of the detector. So the idea to dilute with another gas in order
will
to
remain.
Exactly. Could be still, the fact that the working voltage would shift to such high voltages, it's an issue per se, let's say.
Yeah.
But then the fact that it's producing more pollutants is another issue to be kept in mind also for future detectors. Yes. An idea could be to use, I didn't go into details on RPCs, but in the RPCs that we use now are made out of backlight.
Mm-hmm, right.
They have to be covered with a layer of linseed oil inside to smoothen the surface, and water vapor has to be added to the mixture. Yeah. And the problem is that in water you have hydrogen, here you have fluoride, you make hydrofluoric acid, which is really bad for the RPCs. So what you can do instead is you can use glass RPCs.
Okay.
You don't have to humidify the mixture because the glass doesn't need water vapor. And then in that case, maybe you can think about running with pure HFO at higher voltages and so on.
Okay. That's great. Thank you so much for this. Yeah.
It is my two cents. Thank you for the question.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. And I think this transitions really nicely into the next talk.
Thank you.
Which I believe Ashak is giving, not Oleg.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay, perfect. Let me start sharing my screen.
Right. So we'll hear from Ashak about eco-friendly gas mixtures for gaseous detectors at CERN and beyond.
Yeah, okay. I suppose you can hear me and you can see my screen very well.
Yes, very well. Please.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity. As you said, that my name is Ashak. So I'm doing particle physics, being part of ATLAS experiment, currently being part of Cambridge, and my focus is basically on this recent project, which we call Anubis. I have a sort of slide on this, what this project is all about, but for now on, you can think of this as a part of the ATLAS sub-detector or a sub-project, which is a sort of official project. So I will also discuss a little bit about eco-friendly gas mixtures, but more or less an overview sort of thing. But I'll start with a sort of a disclaimer, because you will see some sort of information that has already been shared, especially by Luca, and you'll see some of the internet that might be a little bit annoying, but I will try to skip those details. And we'll put focus on only on those things which have actually not been covered. So yeah, with that, I'll get started. So with that little introduction. Climate change, a growing concern. We have heard about it. Hearing about it. I mean, we will hear about it. So it is there. So there are many factors that are contributing to this, this issue. And one of the thing is for which is contributing to this issue is basically this, what we call this greenhouse gas emission, which seems to be one of the major problems. And there have been conferences going on, you know, stressing, you know, the importance of combating, you know, climate change through this reduction of these greenhouse gas emissions. So one of the latest conferences, for example, this, which took recently in Glasgow. So based on these recommendations of what the people are doing around, so I think HEP committee, HEP fine energy physics community is actually committed in reducing these greenhouse gas emissions. So as I said, the focus of this talk will be a little bit overview, mostly on this issue, and share what is the ongoing activities and planned mitigation measures that are being undertaken by the HEP community. So coming to these gases, why do we use these gases at the LHC experiments? So I have taken an example of these two experiments for ATLAS and CMS. So these are the cutaway views of the CMS. This is ATLAS. This is basically a silicon inner tracker, and then of course EKL and HKL, hadron calorimeter and electromagnetic calorimeter, similar thing here with the ATLAS. So these detectors, even if these are made of silicon, they still need some cooling. You need these detectors, as previous speakers were also giving this, that because of this cooling, they need these gases, these, what we call these, as of now, I call these greenhouse gases. So my focus is not really this part of the, part of this talk. I mean, my focus is not really on this part, but rather what I call it, this part. So these are basically the muon chambers. For example, in the CMS, we have these the muon chambers. Most of these are using basically the gases. So for example, there are these drip tubes, RPC, residue chambers, CSCs, GEMs. Similar story here with the ATLAS. We have monitor, drip tubes, residue chambers, you know, all CSCs, thin gap chambers. Most of them are using these greenhouse gases. You can imagine these how much gases these detectors are going to use. So why do we use these gases? Simply just a simple thing, undergrad thing, that we use this for the to operate these detectors. So we have a sort of radiation coming in. We have a sort of, you know, gas chamber here filled with a gas. This radiation comes, it ionizes, we get an electron and, you know, ion, and we collect them after, you know, because we also have an electric field, we get this sort of this ionization thing, and then we collect these charges, and so we get the sort of signal. So yeah, so that's why we use. So we can literally use any sort of gas, but argon is choosing because of these best properties. It's inert, cost factors are being taken into account, and also many other factors that we choose, mostly argon. Then we also have a situation where we can have, for example, these ionization radiations can also create sort of these photons, which we need to absorb. Otherwise, they can give us sort of a, some unwanted signal or something else. So we use a sort of a conch gas we call, for example, CO2 or something else. So all I want to say is that basically, whenever we operate these detectors, we operate them, in sort of a mixtures, depending upon our application, why we want to deploy our detectors. For example, for timing purpose, we also add this CF4 gases. And so these mixtures mostly are, as previous speakers also do, that these are basically these sorts of mixtures, like isobutane, we have SF6, CF4, and all these sort of things. And then what's the problem? We can use these mixtures, but as of now, most of these detectors we operate, we use these gases and we directly throw them in the atmosphere. So what's happening, as previous speakers also said, that these gases do have a global warming potential. We can assign this, for example, for CO2, it's assigned as 1 based on this definition. And then depending upon, you can see that how this is changing, how much global warming potential these gases do have. So how much we are throwing at CERN these gases out, how much we are contributing to this, discourse. So you can see, for example, just a little pie diagram. So you can see there are 3 scopes, which I have explained here. So my focus is on this part. So basically in the scope 1, we have these LHC experiments. This part is basically used by the, you operate the detector and then you throw this out, this much out. And then this part is being used by, for cooling and similarly for other experiments. So, And this is a small part, for example, Kettering and other things, which is being done at CERN. And to give you an idea how much this is, basically, if you see, this is the consumption from electricity, these sorts of emissions coming from the consumption, electricity energy consumptions from France and Hungary. This small portion, you can see how much this is comparison to this. To give a little bit of estimate, so you can see in terms of tons, you know, scope one, scope two, and so you can see tons of, you know, CO2 equivalent that we are, that's basically just to quantify these numbers. To compare run two with run three, as again, this has already been shown. So this part, if I see that this one is a run two and run three, this is a basically, you might see this has gone a little bit, you know, down, but this is really a shutdown period. But if we have to say something like here, for example, this part is basically coming from the particle detection. And then, you know, this is again for detector cooling. And this is, you know, other experiments like R&D and some heating and all the stuff. But my part is basically focused on this part, which is basically particle detection thing. So if I want to have a look where what sort of these gases are, mostly you can see that this is sort of this thing where we have mostly okay, let me just drag this away a little bit. This is okay. Going back to that one. Okay, so this is mostly isobutane. You can see that how much fraction is this one and how much it's contributing to this global warming potential. And this is what our focus is, basically. Having a look to this run one versus run two comparison. So where these gases are actually coming from, you know, individual detectors. So this is mostly the picture. These are different LHC experiments. So this is, you can see from Atlas RPC and something similar from the CMS RPC. And this dashed line is basically, you know, run one scenario, and this is the run two. So, and this is, of course, as previous speakers also told, that this is coming from the, you know, sort of the leaks that helping, you know, developing over a period of time. So overall, if you see that most objectives have used these sort of improved with respect to run one, for example, you see this one, this has gone down, but in case of Atlas and CMS, this have gone up. You can see these numbers, you can have a look at these. So coming to these European regulations, then since if we have these sorts of gases we are throwing out, then there are also some regulations we have to face, and these regulations have been, you know, in place from 2015 onwards. So this is a sort of summary of what these regulations are relevant to us. So basically, they are saying that to ban the use of the greenhouse gases by eco-friendly gas alternatives are available, and, you know, do check whether there are leaks and all those things. You know, if possible, there is a recover to recover these sorts of these gases at the end of, you know, life, do that as well. Because of these regulations, you can see this sort of costs going up. I mean, regulations came into place somewhere here, but then you can see because they became unavailable in the market and the costs have gone up and they are now going down, but because this is due to the industrial conversion to new low global warming potential, so they are becoming available. So these are the sort of what we call the phase down policy even being implemented by, being worked out at CERN as well. So this is basically if we treat this as a sort of a 100%, like this scenario at this timeline, and then going down, this is something what we are hoping to achieve in the next few years or maybe a decade or so. So we are somewhere here. And this concern, so we have to, because of all these factors, we have to look really for this new environmentally friendly gas mixtures, which is basically necessary to reduce these greenhouse emissions if we have to operate these detectors. CERN has already placed these some of the strategies in place. They are there, so we just need to act on these. So the first thing is, for example, replacing these F gases with, you know, CO2, because CO2 has a lower gas, you know, global warming potential. So if it's possible to replace that thing, to use that one to do a sort of a leak repair campaign and to use this. So these are basically short-term plan, and this is what we call the long-term plan. This is what is currently being, worked on. And this is basically what we have to look for, finally. So why is it relevant for us as at working at Cavendish? So it's also being part of the ATLAS, I do recognize that for ATLAS, I'm working on the muon detectors. So on apart from that, this is also relevant for our new project, which is, I call this Anubis, which is an underground billiard in-shaft in-search experiment. So it's a proposal to look for long-lived particles at LHC CERN. So it's the idea is to basically to instrument the ATLAS ceilings with these RPC detectors and to have these sorts of two disks over here which can be taken removed out. So whole the story is narrated here. Some of the recent works is here. What is going on in this Anubis side? So the idea is the thing is that these Anubis project is going to use these PIS-7 type RPCs. These detectors are using similar gases and all the stuff. So because the detector volume is such a large, you want to cover all this area and volume. So it means that we really need to step in to look for the alternative gases. Going back to this recent involvement at CERN. So this is basically some of the things that we have been contributing to. These are some of the measurements we were involved last year, basically trying to use this CO2 plan fix, put 30% or 40% of CO2 and do some sort of measurements and impact based on these studies and also some other studies. So ATLAS has already switched to 30% with this CO2 mixture. So meaning that less global warming gases compared to what we were doing earlier. Apart from that, these are some of the ongoing activities that we have recently started at Cavendish. So these are, for example, one of the RPCs that we are studying in the laboratory downstairs, and then this is sort of DAC and all in the beginning stage. So we are just taking over on these things. And this is a sort of gas mixing stem that we have put together. And some of the results recently, just the beginning, trying to repeat what is already in the literature and trying to get into the hold of what we can do and what we can contribute in the future. These are some of the results I have just copied from our student groups that, recently have been doing these studies here at Cavendish. So this is also a really interesting plot that we have been, where we can see basically how this introducing this CO2 thing with the different gases shifts this critical voltage, basically, which is basically the efficiency shift, looking for the efficiency or where the detector is not efficient versus inefficient. I will stop here with saying that it's just a beginning. It's still a long way to go. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. And thanks also for staying on time. Yeah. Questions? Maybe I can, Hannah, go ahead.
I just have a very, very quick one. You mentioned the difference between your short-term plan and long-term plan. What sort of timescale is that? Is that like, I don't know.
Yeah, we are hoping, in this case, for example, if we have to build, for example, if I give an example of our own project, let's say, Anubis, this has to go, there, let's say after 31, 32, it completes. So before that, we have to make sure that we are able to run these detectors with, sort of these new gas mixtures, which have this either less global warming potential or, almost zero, like eco-friendly. So this is like, we're talking about 7 to 8 years of timeline for this project, and similar stories for other, if there's a technical shutdown, long-term shutdown coming, on the way, I'm hoping that people will come up with some new results so that they can use those new gases.
Cool, thank you. I just find it interesting, we have this imminent feeling of the climate being a problem.
It might take a little bit longer, but I think people are using these new ideas and pushing things together, at least doing but I'm hopeful that we can do better than what we have been doing in the past.
Right, okay, so thank you.
Okay, thanks. Greg.
Hi, on that slide you've got showing now, is the volume of this detector really 40,000 cubic meters?
Well, I've got numbers from one of our project. Yeah, I think this is a huge chapter. I mean, you can see this is really covering the Atlas whole sort of basically this ceiling, and then there are going to be really like three layers of these detectors, the RPC detectors, which I think you can get an idea from this, how this one unit cell we have actually put in, which is currently data taking at the Atlas and cavern, which is a small prototype of this, but we want to eventually replicate those cells, which seems to be, I don't have exact, not sure if this is an exact number, but I'm sure that this is very close to it.
So that's the gas volume, 40,000 cubic meters.
I think so.
Okay.
Okay. I'm not seeing any other hands. So thanks a lot. Actually, to all the speakers and all of you for participating in the session. We should have the recording on the agenda as soon as we can. And we start again tomorrow at the same time that we did today. So that was 2 p.m. for me. I'm at CERN. So thanks so much, everyone.
Yeah,
see you tomorrow.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you so much. Well, super interesting.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.